Hi, I'm Thad Russell with Reason TV. Today we're talking with Jack Halberstam, Professor of American Studies and Ethnicity, Gender Studies, and Comparative Literature at the University of Southern California. He is the author of 5 books, most recently Gaga Feminism, Sex, Gender, and the End of Normal, and is currently working on a book titled The Wild, on queer anarchy, performance, and protest culture. Thanks for joining us, Jack.
Thank you.
So I've been very influenced by queer theory, but I think most people out there, and especially this audience, think of it generally as sort of politically correct word games. So what is queer theory and why should anyone care?
Unfortunately, I think the question of why anyone should care about it extends to all of academia nowadays. But queer theory has more contact and more relevance to activism and politics and most things that go on in the university. It's a way of thinking about identity, community, politics that doesn't strive for normativity or respectability or assimilation, but that actually is comfortable being at odds with or queering the idea of normativity to begin with. It's a way of saying we're not trying to fit in, we actually do believe that there are different ways of being in the world and we would like to experiment with those ways.
So what's wrong with normativity?
Well, normativity is a kind of standard that nobody actually meets. Very few people actually meet whatever agreed upon idealized notions of normativity we have, but their normativity is a very good way of disciplining people in order to constrain certain forms of behavior. So normativity is what, you know, one philosopher calls a disciplinary method. Whether or not you conform to social norms, you are still regulated by them.
So if you're interested in a particular notion of freedom, queer theory might be useful for you.
Queer theory is, again, very much under the influence of certain forms of certain schools of thought like post-structuralism, Michel Foucault, Judith Butler, where the idea of freedom is quite a complex concept. So it wouldn't just be like, oh yeah, we believe in freedom. It would be freedom within these ways of thinking is a set of constraints and possibilities, prohibitions and violations. And within that, let's think about what ways we might want to cultivate a being that maximize the possibility of freedom.
Right, so in this country, we are not free to take certain drugs.
In most countries, you're really not free in the sense that freedom is an ideal.
And it's not just the law that keeps us from taking drugs or having illicit sex. It's also norms. It's cultural norms. So are you suggesting that the power of culture may be as powerful or more powerful than legal norms?
I think I'm not going to say culture here as so much as social. So let's just take the most people grow up in some family format or another. And that family format is pretty clearly defined as, you know, hopefully two parents, often one parent, an extended family, and then children who are basically being raised within a system where the norms that they are introduced to are pretty standard across a very wide and diverse population. And those norms are in many ways curtailments on what somebody might call freedom. We don't let kids just run around wildly. We actually demand of them that they tailor their behavior according to certain standards. And that training then becomes part of normative adulthood.
So is the family at the root of all of this?
You know, the family is a really interesting system at this point because it's kind of outlived its usefulness in some ways. I mean, there are a few people on the right or the left today who think that the family is in great shape. The family is a bit broken down as a concept, mostly because people move around a lot more than they used to. People are in many more relationships over the course of a lifetime than they used to be. People are very conflicted and at odds about how to raise children. And children also, in many ways, benefit from not being raised simply within nuclearity. So the family is a really good unit for cultivating social norms. And as the family kind of begins to come apart, I think that there are questions about how to impose norms, how to restrict behaviors, how to cultivate ways of being that we can agree on.
So libertarians are very interested in not being told what to do. Should they attack the nuclear family?
Well, I mean, I don't think this is about attacking any given institution, or nor do I really think that anyone can decide that they don't want to be told what to do. I mean, we all endlessly tell each other what to do, and whether it's a state controlling you, or whether it's your cause navigation system, or whether it's your bank account dictating to you what you can or cannot do, we all live in a system where there are multiple restrictions, multiple constraints, and multiple opportunities. But these are all legislated according to scripts. There is no place where people should just be free to do whatever they want to do. That's, at this point in time, I think that's really a fantasy.
But the family does keep us from doing particular things. It does. It is where we are trained to be civilized adults, right? And civilization
right.
comes with all of these restraints that enforce normativity, right?
Right. For me, the family is just it's an unimaginative structure. It doesn't necessarily give children the best opportunity for, you know, cultivating self, and it also locks parents into child-rearing practices that they often don't care to be a part of either. So I think as a society, we are living with an anachronistic structure that we would do well to rethink.
So queer theory is generally concerned with, although not always, but generally concerned with gay and lesbian issues and sexuality, but can we apply it to understand more fully things like foreign policy or immigration policy or the war on drugs or economic policy? Is there a way to get at those things with queer theory? Can it be useful there?
I think it can, and I think there are lots and lots of theorists and writers who have used a queer methodology or a queer theoretical approach to ask questions about precisely foreign policy, military proceedings, war on terror, war on immigrants in this country, and so on. It is true that queer theory developed as a way of thinking in relationship to sexual minorities who realized, you know, gay, lesbian, trans people realized that the way in which the state was levying restrictions against them was not always in the form of policy, but was often through much more covert operations like morality. And so Gail Rubin's, you know, classic essay, Thinking Sex, which some people see as sexual libertarianism, for example, suggested that we needed forms of erotic justice that released us from these cumbersome and outmoded ways of thinking about sex, some of which, by the way, in her reasoning, were actually coming from feminism rather than simply coming from fundamentalist Christians. For her, it was a way of thinking about sex that then pushed us towards certain social norms that resulted in our seeing the family as inevitable, that reinforced whiteness, that reinforced certain forms of citizenship that we would do well to contest. So if you begin with that kind of framework and move forward, if you think in terms of erotic justice and you realize how many issues sexuality is a part of, you can begin to get into some of these larger issues about war, about militarism, and about immigration.
So let's talk about militarism and war. How can queer theory be used to understand the war on terror, say?
Well, because there are many components to the ways in which we characterize our so-called enemies that use sexual metaphors and are deeply embedded in ways of othering that depend upon this same sexual morality. So when, you know, after 9/11, there were so many really homophobic discourses out there about Osama bin Laden. And at the same time, some 3-4 years later, when the, you know, war on terror had really taken hold in Iraq, and all of those images came out from Abu Ghraib, right, of U.S. soldiers torturing Iraqi prisoners in jails, you could see how deep this strand of sexual othering went, because the prisoners in Abu Ghraib weren't being tortured simply by being chained to the walls. They were being arranged in sexual tableau, by the way, that were being orchestrated by American soldiers and then characterized as perverse. So in many ways, after Abu Ghraib, there is actually no way to understand the war of terror without queer theory. Those kinds of images make no sense unless you have an understanding of the way in which sexuality is constantly being deployed in the way that people think about otherness.
Right. And the Taliban are a bunch of pedophiles.
Right. The Taliban are a bunch of pedophiles, as opposed to, you know, good old red-blooded American masculinity being constructed as pedophilic from, you know, the way in which we groom young girls for, you know, for high fashion from a very early age, to the way in which we absolutely encourage and turn a blind eye to huge age disparities between men and women in everyday relationships. We're quite happy. In fact, there's about to be a TV show called Trophy Wife about an older man with a younger woman. We are so comfortable with this relationship of the rather old man to the very young woman that we simply fold it into sitcom culture, for God's sake. But at the same time, we're sure that in Islam, there's a sort of institutionalized pedophilia. This is a country with institutionalized pedophilia, really.
I was struck by the novel The Kite Runner, in which the villain, the Taliban villain, is a pedophile, right? And enslaves a child and as a sex slave. And it sort of, the novel was essentially positing that this was what was really wrong with those guys.
Right, and that's a common trope of othering, that you find an example of probably an individual who, you know, is pathological in some way, and you now use this individual as representative of a culture. Now, what if we looked at the U.S. and looked at that recent case of Ariel Castro, who kept three women hostage in his basement for 3 years, which, by the way, is actually not so uncommon, as it turns out, in American culture. There are many of these situations where men keep young kids or women hostage in their basements. This is not as uncommon as you may think. What if that became the representation of the U.S. out in the world? This is what American men do. We would think that that was outrageous, but it's about equivalent to taking an example of a pedophile from somewhere in the Arab world and saying that this is representative of that culture's belief system.
This might be slightly off topic, but what do you think of the Anthony Weiner scandal?
Well, I think that it's kind of pathetic, and it's pathetic that U.S. mainstream politics comes down to this kind of scandal mongering. I think that he himself is a pretty pathetic mode of attention seeking on the one hand. On the other hand, it seems as if the U.S. public has a very low tolerance for these kinds of sexual scandals, and yet many of these politicians are engaged in one scandal after the other and seem to bounce back. I can't really imagine a situation where a female candidate, a gay candidate, a black candidate could survive the kind of scandals that white male candidates regularly survive.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what seems to me that he is the target of what women are normally the target of, which is slut shaming, right?
Mm. Maybe. I mean, I think it's pretty different. I don't think that it's about slut-shaming. I think it's about really juvenile behavior. It's not for me necessarily the fact that he is a sexual being. It's more this high school activity of taking shots of his wiener and sending it to people that I'm like, really, is this like acceptable behavior from elected politicians? It's more about the, for me, the puerile quality of the engagement and the deep tolerance for adolescent male behavior that would not be tolerated in kind among women.
What do you think of the idea that sort of American formal culture, the politicians, the business leaders, the teachers in schools, is deeply puritanical, that popular culture is, of course, awash in hedonism, but formal, what I call formal culture, requires a strict adherence to Puritan values, and that if you stray from it at all, if you send a picture of your penis to some woman, you cannot hold elected office in this country. What do you think of that? Does that make sense to you?
My guess is that we could go through the phones of many people in Congress today and find that you actually can hold elected office having sent pictures of your penis worldwide. I think that the notion of puritanical kinds of mentalities in the U.S. is only countered by an extremely expressive sexual culture that covers it up with this sort of sheen of morality. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's more of a kind of hypocritical sexual culture than truly puritanical. There's not much that's really puritanical anymore about the U.S. other than this streak of moral outrage that usually comes from people who are about to be caught in their own scandal.
Right. Can you explain the concept of heteronormativity?
Well, heteronormativity is a term that people started using in order to explain how it is that we come to expect heterosexual behavior from young people. When we raise kids, at any given moment, that kid may express a contrary desire. There's nothing in a 6 or 7 year old that necessarily says that they have to be, they will inevitably be heterosexual. So heteronormativity is the enforcement of heterosexuality across the population. And it's an enforcement that doesn't come by saying you must be heterosexual. It's an enforcement that is cultivated through expectation and through the belief that at heart most people are heterosexual. So it's because it's believed to be a normative orientation, it therefore takes on the weight of something authentic, something real, something true, something natural. By contrast then, once you've established heterosexuality as authentic, real, true, natural, homosexuality begins to look tainted, aberrant, and pathological. So I think as theorists, people are kind of interested in how that breakdown happens. Even though you can point to the Anthony Weiners of the world, all kinds of heterosexual, particularly guys, who engaged in behavior that, if you scrutinize it, looks pretty perverse, because they're heterosexual, they're still rendered as normative, right? So even a very, proper homosexual couple could easily be cast as aberrant within a system of heteronorms.
I was going to ask you, what does heteronormativity include? What does the heteronormative way of life include? Is it just heterosexual sex, or is it more than that?
No, that's a great point. It's there's a presumption of monogamy, there's a presumption of marriage, there's a presumption of the nuclear family without any other kinds of liaisons going on the side. Mm-hmm. There's a presumption of gender normativity within the family, certain roles for men, certain roles for women, certain proclivities for the children, certain ways of raising kids. And all of these things, rather than anyone ever sitting a child down and saying, this is the way it is, these are almost invisible cues that are given to men and to women, to children, to push them seamlessly towards what's presumed to be normative adulthood, i.e. heterosexual, married, reproductive coupledom.
One of the things that I've always been attracted to in gay culture is, and what it's been criticized for, is its sort of embrace of a perpetual childhood, right?
Right.
And certainly gay culture has always been attacked that way. Whether or not it's true is another question, but it's certainly been attacked as perpetually juvenile, and I actually sort of like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's because there's sort of this shunning of the expectations of good American citizenship and the good family person. It's about enjoying life, it's about pursuing pleasure, it's about personal freedom, it's about doing what one wants against social norms. So I wonder what you thought about sort of adulthood and how it's enforced, and childhood.
Well, since we were talking about heteronormativity,
right,
That's where you would now start to use your concept of heteronormativity.
Mm-hmm.
So within heteronormativity, there are very clear boundaries between adolescence and adulthood, between play and work, between growing up and being an adult, right? And it is true that in queer culture, especially for people who don't aspire to become parents and to have families, there's much more blurry lines between, you know, what's proper to youth and what's proper to adulthood. But we also have very heteronormative conceptions of what constitutes adolescence. And adolescence for boys and adolescence for girls are two really different things.
Absolutely.
Adolescence for white people and adolescence for people of color,
absolutely,
two really different things.
Right.
So I think that on the one hand, one would be very interested in thinking about fun and games and the ludic in relationship to the queer. But I think on the other hand, one would want to keep firmly in mind that, again, we tolerate a very long extended adolescence for white male subjects and for just about nobody else, just about nobody else. So a man of color who is, you know, working, just doing stuff in his basement still at the age of 48 is considered to be somebody who has failed.
Right.
You know, a white guy in his basement doing, you know, whatever projects he's doing is an alternative guy who's letting his wife work, you know, something like that. So we're very particular and specific about how we think about adolescent depending upon the subject we're talking about.
Right, fair points. In your most recent book, you have critiqued feminism through Lady Gaga. Can you talk about that?
I'm not critiquing feminism. I'm arguing for a new form of feminism. And many, many people seem to be doing this, but from a more conservative perspective. So just think of, you know, these books that we've seen recently. There's that woman...
Lean In.
There's Lean In by Sandberg. There's another woman, her last name's Venka, Susanna Venka, I think, who has basically is saying that the family is failing and marriage is failing. Why? Because women have abandoned their historic mission to, you know, be domestic helpers to men. And she argues that if only women would go back to being women, men would go back to being men, everything would be okay again. So I'm trying to say at this moment that we have corporate women telling other women to just lean in and get a piece of the pie. At this moment where we have conservative, Christian, right-wing women telling other women to go back into the kitchen and be proper women, we need a new feminism. Feminism's work is not done. Men and women, it's not as if we have something like equality. What we have is a continuing stratified society within which certain expectations that we have of women are different from the expectations we have of men. And so I argue that Lady Gaga is just for me a symbol of a particular mode of femininity proper to our historical moment that we might look at for clues about where to go next with feminism.
What is it about Lady Gaga that you find attractive?
Well, that she's outrageous. She is the kind of Andy Warhol figure of her generation. She figured out how to use all of these different media technologies to have a voice at a moment when you're here today and over tomorrow. She had a certain longevity. She managed to straddle both avant-garde performance and heavy-duty pop rotation. Early on in her career, people were saying that her gender was ambiguous, that maybe she was intersexed, she was called a hermaphrodite. She seems to be unreadable to people in a way that I find intriguing and interesting. I also think the word Gaga is a great word. It goes, people have used that term all the way back to surrealism and Dadaism in the 1920s, and it's generally a word that has a similar sensibility to queer. It's to go gaga, it's like being queer, it's being a little bit off, a little bit crazy, a little bit insane. And I felt that it was time for feminism to go a little bit gaga.
Right. Rather than run for president or become a CEO.
No,
go
gaga, exactly.
Be wild,
right. Go a little crazy, think outside of these logics.
Right. Is this part of a critique of what some people have seen as a sort of puritanical sexual attitude and feminism?
Well, yes, except that puritanical way of thinking within feminism was really proper to the 1970s, and anything that really deserves the name feminism anymore has a very wide-ranging understanding of sexuality and sexual freedoms. So I think that would be a mistaken reading of feminism at this point.
Unfortunately, we'll have to leave it there today.
Okay.
I want to thank Jack Halberstam for joining us today. For Reason TV, I'm Thad Russell.